I call the House Committee, the House Energy Committee meeting to order. Today is Thursday, February 19th, and the time is 1:42 p.m. Members present are Representative Edgman, Representative Kopp, Representative Costello, Representative Johnson, Representative Ruffridge, Co-Chair Holland, and myself, Co-Chair Donna Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to remind folks to silence their cell phones. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Griffin Plush, and he will take care of it. Before we get started, I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Cheryl Cole, and Doug Bridges from the Juno LIO for technical support. On today's agenda, we have two bills where we will be hearing public testimony, and we will be introducing the amendments for House Bill 164, Net Metering Program and Fund. So we're going to start off today, since we've got Representative Eichscheid and his staff in the office. That will be our first public testimony. And Representative Eichscheid, if you can come to the table and give us a super quick recap to start us off. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Ted Eichscheid, I represent House District 22, Northeast Anchorage, North Modun. And thank you for having me briefly introduce House Bill 257, Plug-in Solar. The bill, it does three basic things. First of all, it defines a new class of small solar, it's called appliances. So it defines these, I call them plug-in solar. It exempts these small systems from interconnection and net metering requirements. And finally, it requires product safety certifications for safe use. And then the context for this bill is very similar legislation is passed in Utah. Six other states are considering it, including ours, in the legislation before you. So even though it's new to the United States, it's not new. And for that context, my understanding is Germany is the initial spearhead of these technologies being used, and it's been used there for about 10 years, and there's apparently 4 million homes that use this technology. So that is a very brief summary, Madam Co-Chair, and I appreciate the committee hearing me today.
Thank you very much. Since Representative Eichscheid is here, does the committee have any quick questions before we get to public testimony? Excellent. Thank you very much. We will now hear public testimony. Since we've got just one on the line for this, we'll have 3 minutes for public testimony. So public testimony is now open. I'll ask for pro forma. Is there anyone in the room here for public testimony? Seeing and hearing none, we will go to the line. So we have two folks online. One of them is Julie Vogler, who is here from the RCA to help with any questions as well. But for public testimony, we have Danny Chapman, the State Director for Alaska Environmental. Please put your name on the record and begin your public testimony.
Absolutely. Hello, everyone. My name is Deanna Chapman. I live in Anchorage in District H-15, and I'm the State Director of Alaska Environment. Thank you to the chairs and the committee for hearing testimony today. I support HB 257 and encourage you to pass the bill. Plug-in solar will allow more people to generate and use renewable energy from sources that keep our environment clean and never run out. Plug-in solar will provide another option to improve energy independence, self-sufficiency, resiliency, and help protect our air and water. And right now, this technology lives in a legal gray area. This legislation will help define the tech and statute, establish state safety standards by clarifying systems need to be UL certified, and also remove unnecessary red tape on installation by exempting these small systems from interconnection agreements. 1,200 watts is a pretty small amount of power, and most homes will use the bulk of what those panels produce in home and not send any back into the grid. And I see this technology as a gateway for more rooftop installations as well. Many Alaskans are a little shy about solar due to our extreme light seasonality, and having an option to try solar out at a smaller scale for a relatively low price will help more Alaskans to feel confident about larger investments, both for our own homes and then also at the utility level. So thank you so much for the chairs and committee for your time.
Thank you very much. Seeing no one online, we will now close public testimony. Pardon me. I haven't banged the gavel yet, so it appears someone else has just called in. Brief at ease. Thank you. We're back on the record. We do have one more person online to testify. And then just to let folks know, we're not planning on trying to amend and move this out of committee today. So there is opportunities for providing written testimony to the committee. And I will get the email for that and share that with you shortly. Oh, I have it right here. Thank you, Co-Chair Holland. It is house.energy@akleg.gov. So anyone wishing to do further public testimony, please email the committee and that can be on the record. So now we will go to Wesley Schrock. You've got 3 minutes for public testimony. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Wesley Schrock, representing brightsaver.org, a California-based nonprofit dedicated to building a plug-in solar movement in the United States, making solar ownership affordable and accessible to everyone. We run pilot programs, installing plug-in systems to see what works and what doesn't work, and to gather savings data. We also work on policy, supporting state level enabling legislation nationally. I am testifying today to encourage the committee to support HB 257 to allow the people of Alaska to access plug-in solar, saving money by reducing their electricity bills. This is a market-driven solution requiring no tax credits or public funds. It's just cutting red tape. Importantly, Alaska will be joining a national movement and in so doing, building a market for plug-in solar in the U.S. Last year, Utah was the first state to pass legislation enacting HB 340, a bipartisan, budget-neutral regulatory reform exempting plug-in solar from interconnection rules, and immediately two companies began selling systems in Utah. This year, already 27, so not six, 27 states have introduced legislation, with a few more expected to do so. In conversations with manufacturers, both those selling in Utah and those sitting on the sidelines, with five or six more states on board, they will expand product offerings or enter the U.S. market for the first time, selling in all states with legislation, including Alaska. Given the sizable demand, people do indeed want this. We model that competition will drive system costs below $1 per watt, with payback periods declining to 2 to 4 years. Thank you to Co-Chairs Holland and Mears for considering this and to the members of the House Energy Committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your public testimony. Would you be available for a question from Representative Ruffridge?
Yes, certainly.
Thank you. Appreciate that. It's not always something we do a public testimony, but you're a little more than a general public member. So we appreciate your technical support, which I'm sure is the question that Representative Ruffridge will have. Representative Ruffridge. Maybe I'm making a wrong assumption.
Are you sure? Sure.
Maybe it's policy.
Yeah. No. Thank you for your testimony through the chair. We've been hearing today and in the first hearing for this that this is plug-in solar. I did a little research on this after our first hearing. It seems a little more technical than just plug it in. Do these devices have to be on their own circuit? It's not just plug it into an outlet, correct?
So it is just, thank you for the question. So it is just plug it in. So to prevent the specific issue of breaker masking, they should either be on a dedicated circuit, or if they are plugged into a branch circuit with other things plugged into that same circuit, then there are other protections. UL outlined sort of three different options. One of them, the probably most common one, will be what's called a power control system that basically monitors current in that circuit and powers down the plug-in solar system should wires overheat. So yes, it is true that you just plug them in, but UL any system that is UL listed and installed according to UL guidelines, manufacturer's guidelines, will be safe for homes and prevent there'll be no fire hazards. I hope that answers the question.
Just to follow up, if I may, Madam Chair.
Follow up, Representative Ruffin.
Thank you. Through the chair. So I might have missed just the component of that. It's best if it's on a dedicated circuit, but you said that it can be installed without a dedicated circuit?
Mr. Schrock?
That is correct. If you install on a dedicated circuit, then you do not need those additional safety features that I was referring to when it's installed on a branch circuit with other outlets on that circuit.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Schrock, thank you very much for being available for technical questions. I've got another question from Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate you being online today. I've got actually two questions. First off, following up on Representative Ruffridge's question, my understanding is that if I go to a online seller of plug-in solar things, I could probably buy one of these and it would show up in a box and it would have a plug on the end of it. And I could go take that plug and plug it into the wall, I believe. So, A, am I correct that these devices commercially available just have a standard three-prong thing that I can just go plug in anywhere I want to? And, you know, if that's the case, what ensures that somebody buying one of these is going to install them correctly to the UL installation requirements, as opposed to I see the end of a plug, I see a hole in the wall, and I connect the two, and I'm off to the races. And I don't know whether there's some experience in Europe or other places that have adopted this more widely on how they've done this in a way to ensure safe installation.
Mr. Schrock?
Yes, thank you, Representative Holland. Yeah, so what I can speak to, so what is happening in Utah, for example, there is one manufacturer there selling a system that does have the standard three-prong plug. And there, during setup, the manufacturer has the user, attest or verify, or not verify, attest or state that they are using a dedicated circuit. I will also state that the UL standard that just came out in December of this past year, in which UL, and they've also announced a testing program for the standard in January, that standard requires a proprietary plug and professional installation. And so basically it eliminates the possibility of someone unboxing it and improperly using it because of this, or it makes it much more difficult to do so because of the proprietary plug. So you would need to then get an electrician to reconfigure your outlet and make sure that, you know, you're either on a dedicated circuit or you're on a branch circuit with adequate protections. So the new safety standard basically makes it very difficult to do what you're saying. Existing products on the market, there is more, admittedly, more possibility for misuse.
Thank you, Mr. Schrock. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. And just one other follow-up. In terms of your view, I was going to say a balcony view, but I guess I did. Of the other states, I think you said 27. I'm curious, you know, we've heard some concerns about the adoption of this, particularly in smaller utilities that might see a number of these. Are you aware of other states that have addressed and overcome objections of wide-scale adoption of these and the impact that it might have on the utility, particularly if you have any knowledge of states that have looked at this in terms of smaller microgrid utility applications that would be more similar to Alaska?
Yeah, so the best I can offer, and I can share this, I can email this report to the committee, is we did commission a study on the impacts on the grid with wide-scale adoption, but that was done sort of at a regional level, dividing the U.S. into four different regions and looking at what would be the impact if a bunch of households started installing these systems. Basically, the main conclusion was that plug-in solar functions pretty much like energy efficiency measures and would have very little impact on the grid, even at penetration rates of up to 40 or adoption rates of up to 40%, that the utilities would not need to sort of invest into infrastructure to handle what might be coming back onto the grid from these plug-in systems. But again, that is sort of at a regional level, not at, you know, what would happen if everybody in the block or everybody in a small service area installed one of these. I will say that if systems include batteries, which is what we recommend, that export to the grid is almost non-existent, because in that case, you can, the battery will soak up all of the additional capacity that the panels are using that is not used into the home. And then at night, you come home, you use everything that's stored in the battery, and then you repeat the next day. So batteries are key to minimizing impacts on the grid and allowing it so that most of the electricity is consumed within the home.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your willingness to answer our technical questions today. Seeing no one else in the room and no one else on the line for HB 257, we will close public testimony. Thank you, Representative Eichheim. We are now going to move on to HB 164. We're going to start off with public testimony, of which we've got two folks online, and I don't believe we have anyone in the room. I'll allow 3 minutes again for public testimony. We also have a number of folks online for questions, both from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and the Alaska Energy Authority. We will start again with Ms. Deanne Chapman, the State Director for Alaska Environmental. Hold on, I need to open public testimony. I will open public testimony. Thank you very much. Ms. Chapman, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you so much. My name is Deanne Chapman. I live in Anchorage in District 15, and I'm the State Director of Alaska Environment. And thank you again to the chairs and committee for taking testimony. We support HB 164 and encourage you to vote for an annual net metering policy in Alaska. Solar panels are one of the cleanest and most efficient ways for us to generate electricity, and generating from the sun keeps our air and water clean and allows Alaskans greater self-sufficiency. And favorable net metering policies are one of the best ways to inspire more individuals and businesses to invest private dollars into the infrastructure needed to power our lives. We've seen this play out in many states. Annual net metering leads to higher adoption of solar and should be pursued. As of 2024, Alaska ranked 50th in the nation for grid-connected residential solar, and we produce just enough energy to power 3,381 average American households for a year. And we can do so much better than that. And many of the states with high adoption have or had generous annual net metering policies that help them get there. And this bill is one of the best ways to kick that adoption into gear. So definitely want to see annual net metering in Alaska. And thank you so much to the chairs and to the committee for hearing testimony.
Thank you again for testifying, Ms. Chapman. Next, we have Henry Kroll from Peninsula Solar. Please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello. Thank you, Co-Chairs Mears and Holland and committee members for the opportunity to speak on House Bill 164. My name is Henry Kroll. I live in Soldotna. I'm a 26-year Alaska resident, and I adopted solar about 3 or 4 years ago on my home and on my medical practice, as well as on another commercial development that I own in Soldotna. We formed Peninsula Solar, which is a solar design and installation company, about 4 years ago, and are getting increasingly busy with solar installations. I support House Bill 164 because I think this would be a tremendous boom to the local solar industry. It's a tremendous incentive to consumers, including homeowners and small business owners who make the investment in a solar energy system. The problem that we see and one deterrent to solar in Alaska is that just like the sun, solar production is very skewed. The solar energy systems overproduce in the summertime and underproduce in the wintertime. And the net result of the overproduction in summer is that we produce too much to use. And if we exceed the monthly net metering, which is currently in place, we end up getting about one third of the value of the solar production. And so this House Bill 164 would allow us to overproduce in the summer and basically build our bank full of credit that we could use when the sun is not shining in the wintertime. And again, it would be a tremendous boom, I think, and a major incentive for more people and small businesses to go solar. And I see it as a benefit to anyone or any business that chooses to go solar or adopt some other form of renewable energy. So I urge the committee to support House Bill 164 and pass it. And I, again, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Seeing no one else in the room and no one else online for public testimony, I will close public testimony. I'd like to remind folks that you can provide additional written comments through house.energy@akleg.gov since we are not looking to move the bill today. So we're going to move on to, we've got amendments that we would like to introduce and discuss and then hold over for consideration on another day. I believe I need Co-Chair Holland to ask me to move my amendment.
There we go. Do you want me to move the amendment for you or are you going to move it?
I think I need to move
okay.
it.
Okay.
Here's the gavel.
I've got the gavel. I'm in charge. Go ahead, Madam Chair. Co-Chair Mears.
I move Amendment 1, labeled 34-GH157/A.3.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you very much. So I'll have Mr. Plush from my office give a brief summary of the amendment.
My name is Griffin Plush with Office of Representative Mears. Through the chair, Amendment 1 seeks to essentially establish a sunset for the programs that would be established under this bill. Of 10 years. So 2037, the program would stop taking, or the programs would stop taking new applicants for annual net metering. Folks would no longer be able to initiate service. It does preserve at least 7 years of annual net metering service for folks who maybe began in that final year of service so that they can get a period of payback for the installation of a solar system under the annual net metering program.
Thank you. So this is addressing some concerns about the structure of an annual net metering program and inequities of folks that are able to afford the systems in the short term and how those costs get passed on to others. The point of doing this in the short term is that we're in different phase of getting up take of solar panels. And so by providing the incentives early on, as we get more uptake of the technology, then we can consider new policies in a new regime when there is hopefully more local folks making the investment for energy generation.
So, Co-Chair Mears, I don't know that we have talked much about Section 2 in your amendment, which I think is a pretty significant portion of the amendment and the issue about rates and the impact on the rates. I wonder if we could get that on the record in terms of what's happening with Section 2.
Thank you, Mr. Plush. Can you start us off on that?
Can we get a quick at
ease? Brief at ease.
We're back on the record with House Energy, and please proceed, Mr. Rush.
Yeah, so I believe that you're discussing on line three, section two. That is a portion in order for the drafting. I think is essentially a conforming change to ensure that the sunset can proceed accordingly. I don't think there's substantive policy. We can check with Ledge Legal, but I believe that is what that section is essentially conforming to allow the sunset to work correctly. Since it's a little bit of an unusual sunset with that, the ceasing of benefits in 2037 and then full repeal in 2044.
Okay, thanks. Representative Costello, do you have a question? It kind of looked like a question.
Yes, sorry, I do. So what we just heard is Section 2 is conforming to allow for the sunset. I'm curious if we could have somebody from Ledge Legal explain that. I'm curious in particular about the phrase unreasonable preference, and perhaps the RCA online or somebody can answer what that is.
Thank you, Representative Costello. Ms. Vogler, I see you on from RCA. I wonder if you're prepared to be able to share a response to Representative Costello's question about the language that she's referring to.
For the record, Julie Vogler, through Co-Chair Holland, Representative Costello. So unreasonable prejudice or disadvantage ensures that the commission does not discriminate against a certain rate class and give priority to different rate classes, that we treat the rate classes similar when establishing rates.
Follow up, please.
Is that something you already do?
Ms. Vogler, did you understand that question?
Yes, for the record, Julie Vogler, Co-Chair Holland, through Co-Chair Holland, Representative Costello, yes, that is something that we already do.
Follow up.
Perhaps this is a legal question, but if an entity such as the RCA is already doing something and then we put in statute that it has to be done, does that mean that in other areas that we have to place that in statute? Because if they already do it, it seems like it might raise the question whether or not it could happen outside of those guidelines in another situation. So I'm curious, maybe the drafter could explain the purpose then of having this in here if it's already something the RCA does.
So I don't know, Co-Chair Mears, do you want to pick that up, or should we ask Ms. Vogler from RCA to try and continue with that question? It sounds like maybe it was directed towards your office.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holland. We don't have Ledge Legal on the line. Mr. Plush, do you have a...
The only thing I'll say is that I believe a lot of this language is in the existing, through the chair, I believe a lot of this language is in the existing version of HB 164. So it may be a question to some degree for AEA. But I don't have a, in terms of this being in the amendment here, I don't have particular answer right now.
Yeah. And if I can, just to throw a thought in, and then I Representative Costello, it looks like you had a follow up there. But I just observed that one of the key issues that has shown up in this type of bill has been the concern that the rates would be structured in a way that those who participate in annual net metering might benefit at the expense of other ratepayers who don't participate in having a solar system. So I think this is a unique situation about this nature of the potential disparity of benefits and rate impacts that maybe is causing this to be highlighted in this bill and perhaps not highlighted in other more general applications. So I think there is some purpose why it's here and perhaps not other places, but we can follow up on that further. But would you like to follow up beyond that? Okay. Is there any other discussion on Amendment 1? For the moment, we are planning on holding it over, so we're not taking action on it today. But if there's clarifying questions. Okay, for the moment, we're going to hold over Amendment 1 for a future hearing, and we'll proceed on then with the introduction of the next amendment.
Thank you. I move Amendment Number 2, 34-GH1571/A.4.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion again and invite the Co-Chair Mears or her staff to introduce this amendment.
Through the chair, Amendment Number 2 seeks to essentially establish a 2% threshold in terms of rate increases that would trigger the ability for utilities to come to the RCA and ask for modifications to their rates to ensure that the non-consumer generators, that's the folks not receiving the annual net metering service, that they do not see their rates increase. So for example, they could put a surcharge on folks receiving annual net metering that could balance out the costs of annual net metering customers on the utility so as to not spread them to other folks. I think that this is a pretty generous threshold, 2%. We don't anticipate the uptake of annual net metering necessarily based on some analysis from the Alaska Energy Blog to increase rates more than, I think, 0.3%. This sets a threshold that provides a real standard for the RCA to look at in terms of, considering rate cases.
And I'd like some clarification. I'll be told if I'm wrong, but there's existing language that is kind of squishy about an effect on rates. So this puts a firm number to it rather than leaving vague language.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that exactly giving a more, through the chair, a firmer guideline to the RCA. I'll also note, and I forgot to mention this, amendment, has a trigger, for if the net metering reimbursement fund that's currently under HB 164 is not capitalized. So if there's not funds for the net metering reimbursement fund, which in the original design of in the current version of HB 164, that net metering reimbursement fund is supposed to serve as the tool to offset those costs. If that isn't capitalized, this is trying to meet that as well. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you. Any questions on Amendment 2? Representative Casella.
Thank you. So it appears to me that this Amendment 2 is actually providing a definition to what is in Amendment 1 is you're not allowing a prejudice or a disadvantage in Amendment 1. However, it seems to me that a disadvantage is created by the fact that you're going to increase the rates for the non-consumer generators, and you're setting that at 2% and saying in this, if they were to pass, that a 2% increase annually is not a disadvantage. Is that my understanding?
Co-chair Mayors?
Thank you. Through the co-chair to Representative Holland, there is a bias that is in the original bill that would put costs onto other customers, which is the I'll speak for Alaska Energy Authority, and they'll correct me if I'm wrong. The reason for the fund, so that is not borne by other customers. So this is a trigger in case that fund is not capitalized, the annual net metering process can still proceed. In amendment number one, it's limiting the time of that impact.
Follow up, please.
Yeah, and that actually is my point, is that a bias is created, and that this there is a bias. I think that's my point. There is a bias that is created in the bill, in the program.
You want to respond, Co-Chair Mayors?
Yes, through the co-chair to Representative Costello. Yes, there is. It's the reason for the establishment of the fund. We've talked to some folks about what the real impacts would be, and that's anticipated to be far less than 2%. But thought it was good to have a number in there rather than a vague definition.
Thank you.
You bet. Any other questions on amendment number 2? Then we'll be holding over amendment 2 for a future meeting, and we will continue on. I think the next two amendments are mine, so I'm going to hand the chair back over to Co-Chair Mears.
Thank you very much, Representative Holland. Will you move your next amendment?
I'm going to be withdrawing Amendment 3. I don't know that it even got in the packet, but just to be clear that Amendment 3 is not being offered. I will move Amendment number 4, however, which is Work Order 34-GH1571/A.6.
Thank you. I'll object for the purposes of discussion, for explanation and discussion.
Great. Thank you, Co-Chair Mears. This amendment is a further clarification for the bill in a couple areas. I'm going to ask staff, Mr. Truer, to come up and run through the different elements of Amendment number 4, please.
For the record, Tim Truer, I'm staff for Representative Co-Chair Holland. Through the chair, the purpose of this amendment is threefold. First, it's seeking to create a new class of net metering customers that don't seek compensation for the energy they export to the grid. This might include customers with large battery systems or energy systems that are small enough that they're not going to be introducing much energy onto the grid. It requires that utilities provide some sort of streamlined approval for such systems since they are low burden. And come at the exchange of no compensation for the net metering. Second, the amendment pushes back the implementation date for the new net metering rules to April 1st, 2027. That would start the clock on these annual 12-month net metering cycles at the first possible date after the introduction of the integrated resource plan from the Rail Belt Reliability Council. This is meant to be a courtesy to the utilities who have expressed that they have limited regulatory staff that have been have a lot on their plate, and this is meant to prevent them from being stretched too thin. And then finally, this amendment eliminates the requirement for an RCA hearing if the utilities limit the enrollment of new net meter customers in portion of their districts. In portions of their service territory in the name of protecting system reliability. It replaces that RCA hearing with a decision by the utilities board or other governing body. And in such cases, the amendment would require that the utilities notify the RCA and provide them with some sort of technical justification for why that limitation was put in place. And then there's a little bit more in the amendment that are essentially just technical and conforming changes that were suggested by Legislative Legal Services.
Thank you, Mr. Truer. Co-Chair Holland, do you have any clarification you'd like or additional you'd like to put on?
It No additional clarification. I do have a question that I would like to ask of Ms. Vogel from the RCA when we're ready to go on to that.
Let's see if there's other questions from committee members. I'd also like to note we now have Ian Walsh, who's the Ledge Legal Drafter, online as well for questions. At the moment, there's no other questions from committee members. Co-Chair Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the co-chair to Ms. Vogler, I wanted to ask a question just to kind of flesh out a little bit of how the RCA may be viewing what's happening with these amendments and this one in particular in terms of the implementation and this last aspect of the RCA hearing with the utilities. And given that the RCA currently, I believe, can entertain special net meter tariffs if utilities can demonstrate a material cost impact on net meter ratepayers, how do you see that current authority that the RCA has for net metering interfacing with this new bill and this amendment for the work that RCA might be asked to do with the utilities in the future?
For the record, Julie Vogler through co-chair mayors, co-chair Holland. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, please, when you're saying the implementation date, is that where the April 1, 2027, is that what you were referring to?
Through the co-chair Mears, yes, the implementation in 2027 would essentially turn on this new set of net metering rules. And under these new rules, there's this third part of it that changes it so that the RCA is no longer directly involved if utilities limit enrollment on net metering, but they will be notifying you. And I'm curious how you feel that that interacts with your existing net meter authority under your tariffs to address tariffs if there's a material cost impact.
For the record, Julie Vogler through co-chair Mears, co-chair Holland. So as far as the implementation slash effective date of April 1, 2027, our regulations dockets are a two-year timeline. So we would just need to ensure basically once a bill passes and the effective date is implemented, we have 2 years to get those regulations in place. As far as the online, excuse me, page two, where we have the insertion, the language regarding no longer having a hearing and just reporting being required to the commission as to the why the limitation was in place. Right now, honestly, I don't know if that mechanism would be just an informational filing, because if there's not a change to a tariff sheet, sometimes utilities file informational filings. And then the commission, if they wanted to, could take further action on that to get more information for from the utility if needed. As for justifying the limit, they would just need to, the bill's pretty straightforward, this amendment, that they would need to provide the justification why the limit was in place.
Okay, thank you. Can I follow up on one thing?
Follow up, Co-Chair Holland?
Great, thank you. I appreciate that background and just understanding the interrelationship of these two net meter type bills. Back on your comment about the implementation in 2027, did I understand correctly that 2027 would start the two-year clock of regulation promulgation? So am I to understand that it might be that these rules wouldn't be actually in effect until 2 years after that, or 2029, or did I misunderstand the two-year docket period for implementing regulations around these statutes?
For the record, Julie Vogler through co-chair Mears, co-chair Holland, it would be 2 years from the adoptions of the bill. And so it would not be, we would not wait until April 2027 to start a regulations docket. If the bill passed, we would implement a regulations docket at that time if necessary.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. The room cleared out a little bit, but we still have good questions from Representative Costello. Representative Costello.
Thank you. My question has to do with page 2 of Amendment 4 at the bottom. Where it talks about the commission may not adopt a regulation that limits participation based off of the total capacity of generation by the consumer generators. And I'm just curious from the RCA if there's any other place in statute that specifically limits the authority of the RCA.
For the record, Julie Vogler, through co-chair, mirrors Representative Costello. Right now, the limitation is in the existing regulations for net metering, found at 3AAC 50.910B, is where the limitation exists in regulation.
Representative Costello, do you need that citation again?
No, I'm just curious. I'm curious about the precedents for limiting the authority or powers of the RCA, and it sounds like this is happening in regulation, but I'm still curious about how prevalent that is, if limiting regulations exist elsewhere and how common it is.
Ms. Vogler, that's a pretty broad question, but I'm sure she'll do her best.
For the record, co-chair mayors, through co-chair mayors, for the record, Julie Vogler, through co-chair mayors, Representative Costello, could you please repeat your question? I'm not quite following.
Thank you. So my question has to do with limiting the powers of the RCA, and you replied that this part of the amendment deals with a regulation. So my question is, how prevalent is it? How often do we see in regulation that the powers of the RCA are specifically limited?
For the record, Julie Vogler, through co-chair mayors, Representative Costello, I honestly, if it's a regulation, honestly, I'm not aware of where we have these limitations in regulation. And if they were any, there could always be waivers of regulations if need be.
See if you want to. Okay, just one follow up.
Co-chair Mayors.
Representative.
We can go to the follow up. I was also wondering if maybe Mr. Truer has any thoughts on why the section was being put in with that limitation that Representative Costello is asking about.
I'd also like to say we can follow up with some clarification since we're not looking at taking action today. What do you feel about that?
That's fine. I just had one short comment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, it sounds like the RCA can waive regulations. And so if we're putting something in regulations that's limiting the RCA in their activity, they actually have the authority to waive that regulation if they see fit, is what I'm hearing.
Ms. Vogler, do you have a clarification on that? And we can
also... For the record...
Go ahead.
Okay, for the record, Julie Vogler, through co-chair mayors, Representative Costello, while we can't waive the regulations, typically we are able to do it on our own, but typically a utility who is making a filing will request a waiver of that regulation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions or comments from the committee today on the amendment? With that, we'll set amendment number 4 aside for consideration at a later time. Are there further conversation or questions on any of the amendments or the bill before we set that aside for today? Seeing and hearing none. Thank you, everyone, for the discussion today. We've got a lot of pieces moving here, and I appreciate everyone's patience. Thank you, everyone online, for your public testimony and or availability to answer questions. Having participation certainly makes our processes better. So with two bills set aside, that concludes our business for today. We will set an amendment deadline for House Bill 257, which is Representative Eichheit's portable solar energy generation devices, for Monday.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. On the record. So we're setting an amendment deadline for House Bill 257 of Monday, February 23rd at noon. With no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 2:33 p.m. Thank you.